Welcome to this week's edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. We'll check out the new Israeli government more closely and talk about the difference between being pro-Palestinian and anti-Semitic. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
We are just delighted you are with us. Big week news-wise. I don't know where we start. The fact that Bibi is no longer the Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister.
So
much. Yeah, you know, it's going to be interesting. I mean, look, I think it's people are looking at this as a, you know, look, you have to give tremendous respect to Bibi. First of all, his party won by almost double the numbers, the most seats in the Knesset. Thank you. In the Knesset.
Little mind fart there.
Yeah, exactly. So he's still very powerful and be very influential in the government. What you do see is this sort of party of, this coalition governing body now, which is also made up of people that actually served with him, like Avigdor Lieberman, Naftali Bennett, Sa'ar, and others who at one point or another have been members of Likud, have served in the Likud governments. They kind of wanted their own moment to shine, and they saw this as an opportunity to work with Lapid and to work with Abbas and other parties on the left, which I think it's what the people of Israel wanted. I think the Bibi is still very much loved and respected because
by half the country.
But he
is a divisive figure. I mean, there are some people, you are right, who just love Bibi. Ron Dermer, the former ambassador, just loves him and says he's the best thing that's ever happened. There are a lot of people on the other side that have either tired of him or have disliked him from the get-go.
Yeah. Right, but whether or not you're tired of him or not, I think most Israelis still have tremendous respect for him. I mean, look, he's brought Israel through some very tremendous challenges, you know, with Iran, with various wars. Even in the last conflict, the entire government, right and left, got right behind him in defense of Israel, and also with the Abraham Accords, the peace agreement. So you know, even those that are tired of him, you know, they have respect for him. So I think there's that distinction in that, but he's not going anywhere. But this new government, I think a lot of people have, you know, tremendous hope, and it'll be interesting to see what comes in days ahead. Obviously, we mentioned last week some of the reforms they're going to be making on the, as far as religious reforms are concerned, which I believe many here in this country and even many secular Israelis are very excited about, long awaited. So we expect lots of good things to come forward.
Yeah,
clearly
the losers besides Bibi are the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, because they have been catered to, even though they're in a minority position, but Bibi catered to them and gave them a lot of power. And that is going to change because Israel's a secular country.
Right.
I mean, some of the Orthodox Jews in Israel wouldn't consider me as a Reformed Jew Jewish. That is going to be a real sea change. I just wonder, though, if this coalition, which is so disparate, can hang together, at some point.
It's going to be a challenge. I mean, I agree, Mike. I mean, look, you even have, there was a news report, like many Palestinians in the West Bank are calling on Abbas and others in the Palestinian Authority to not engage in peace dialogue with the Biden administration, with Israel. There's this new support for Hamas that's been growing and extreme groups. So it's a very, you know, the question is, you know, they've got some challenges ahead of them. I mean, it's very simple as that. I mean, there's some challenges. I mean, look, Israel, despite what people say about Israel and the Palestinian Authority, There are tremendous security cooperation agreements between the two of them. They have water agreements. They have electricity. There's all types of cooperation that happens behind the scenes on an everyday basis. I mean, even with Hamas down in Gaza, I mean, with Israel sending in daily humanitarian aid and doing different things. So and opening up the borders to allow them to be treated in Israeli hospitals versus their own hospitals in Gaza, because there are hospitals in Gaza, just as there are hospitals in the West Bank. It'll be interesting. There's, you know, certainly, as always, there's always challenging times.
Yeah, but you know, you mentioned Hamas. They were the big winners in the conflict the past couple of weeks, because Abbas has really lost a lot of support and power, and so many Palestinians now are putting their faith in Hamas, which has been labeled not just by Israel, not just by the United States, but by several countries as a terrorist organization. And they have gained a lot of support with the Palestinians, who think that they're their saviors, when they're ripping them off the money that they get.
It's so sad.
The money that is supposed to go to help Palestinians, it comes from around the world, it goes through Hamas, is used to wage war and not used to wage peace.
I mean, just think about this for a moment. So Hamas was bragging about their 500 kilometers of very sophisticated tunnels. So think about subway tunnels. So they built 500 kilometers of tunnels underneath Gaza for the purpose of the terrorist militants to be able to maneuver around sight unseen and to be able to store their weapons. So think about this for a moment. What if they had taken that money that was sent into Gaza, which is about the size and population in an area about Dade County, Florida, right? Think about this. If they had taken that money and had actually used it to build infrastructure, used it to build new apartment complexes, used it to upgrade their sewage plants and their water treatment facilities, used it to build homes and to their farming infrastructure, and just so many things that they could have spent billions of dollars on their people. Instead, their people suffer. They don't have jobs. They don't have employment. They don't have, unless you're part of the elite group, because there is some beautiful housing in Gaza. Unless you're part of the elite group, you don't get to live there. You know, you don't, you've got limited electricity, you've got limited fuel. You know, it's just, women can't go out without a male escort. I mean, it's insane what's happening there. And you think about how the people have suffered, but Mike, you know, I think this goes back to the children. You have an entire generation raised with the education of Hamas. And so there was that one report that came out regarding the textbooks that the European Union had done a very in-depth investigation regarding 156 textbooks that were issued by the Palestinian Authority between 2017 and 2019. And these textbooks, which, by the way, the EU hid this report and didn't disclose.
The public was not aware of this until just recently this came out, right?
I mean, this report is so damning, and how it goes through multiple examples of encouragement of violence against Jews, the demonization of Israel and Jews, making up lies about Jews, multiple attempts to kill their prophet Muhammad. It uses suicide bombers and terrorists as examples of female empowerment. Like, you know, when they're talking about textbooks of math, using math, like they'll use her as an example in a math problem. I'm like, really? And they erase the state of Israel from every single map in their books. And they call it Zionist occupation, and, you know, denied any existence of Israel or Jews being indigenous people there. I mean, what about the Jews who are Palestinians, the Arab Jews, the countless Arab Sephardic Mizrahi Jews? Obviously, we're going to talk to one today. But you know, it's so damning. But you have a generation now, Mike,
that's being raised on that and gets that as supposedly the gospel truth. It's going to be a very tough time and an interesting time for Naftali Bennett and his whole coalition and Lapid. The BBC did a terrific report on what he says is going to be his attempt to unite Israel. Let's take a listen to that.
Now we're going to turn to Israel, though, because the new Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, has chaired his first cabinet meeting and has promised to heal the country's rifts. The right-winger heads an unwieldy coalition whose eight-member parties joined forces to unseat Benjamin Netanyahu after his 12 years in office. Well, Parliament approved the new government by just a single vote. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports.
Israel always has coalition governments, but it's never had one as wide-ranging as this. Headed by a right-wing religious Jew, Naftali Bennett, and Yair Lapid, a secular centrist. With an Arab-Israeli Islamist party joining in an historic first. Winning just 7 of 120 parliamentary seats in the last election, few expected Naftali Bennett to become prime minister. The former Special Forces soldier turned high-tech multi-millionaire began in politics as Benjamin Netanyahu's chief of staff and later joined him in government as defense minister. He's a staunch nationalist, committed to Israeli settlements and opposed to the creation of a Palestinian state. But for the sake of unity, he says now is a time to compromise.
No one will be asked to give up their ideology, but everyone will have to postpone the realization of some of their dreams.
Before he became a politician, Yair Lapid used to interview Israel's leaders. He was a well-known TV news anchor until he turned to politics a decade ago, at a time when social and economic struggles were bringing out middle-class Israelis for mass street protests. After a term as finance minister alongside Benjamin Netanyahu, he spent years in opposition. That was to change last month when the president gave him the mandate to form a new government after the long-time PM was unable to do so. His party had second most votes behind Mr. Netanyahu's. Traditional Palestinian dancing is how the United Arab List celebrated its four seats on election night. It's socially conservative in its outlook, headed by a dentist, Mansour Abbas. Unlike other Arab leaders, he was willing to join even a purely right-wing Israeli government. He says he'll work for the Arab minority that makes up a fifth of the population.
This new coalition is really a patchwork of small and medium-sized parties that have little in common ideologically. They include those on the left and former right-wing allies of Benjamin Netanyahu. What really stitches them together is the desire for change.
The new government will face a formidable opposition leader looking to exploit their divisions. With the thinnest possible majority, it will stick to topics it can agree on, like helping the post-COVID economic recovery. But that won't be easy after last month's mob violence in mixed Arab and Jewish cities, and as tensions continue to simmer in Jerusalem. Yolande Nel, BBC News, Jerusalem.
Let's cross live to Jerusalem, where we have the new Israeli government posing for one of those traditional family photographs. Of course, they're just, here they come. The coalition, of course, approved in a razor-thin vote, 60 to 59, one abstention there. So that traditional family photo, Naftali Bennett vowing to unite the nation, which has been frayed by four elections in 2 years of political stalemate. Naftali Bennett saying that his government would work for the sake of all the people, adding that priorities would be reforms in education, health and cutting red tape, avoiding any contentious issues given the wide political divisions within wide political frames within this coalition group. Benjamin Netanyahu forced out of office after 12 years. And Naftali Bennett, the leader of the Yamina party, will be prime minister until September 2023. It is part of this power-sharing deal. Mr. Bennett will then hand power over to Yair Lapid, head of the centrist Yesh Atid party, for a further 2 years. So we've got the family photo taking place there, live images from Jerusalem of this new coalition government that was voted in with a very, very narrow vote there, razor thin as it's being described, a vote of 60 to 59, one abstention.
And like I said, Laureen, I'm still not convinced that this is going to last long enough for Lapid 2 years from now to become prime minister. If I were a betting person, I guess it's like when you play craps, you're betting against the line. I just can't see it lasting. I'll be amazed. That will be a true miracle if that happens.
But it's at least while we have it, it's exciting. It's exciting to see, the Arab Party, part of the ruling coalition. There's so many things about it that are just so exciting.
But 60 votes. They didn't even get to 61 because one person abstained.
I know. So they actually did not get a majority vote, which does mean there could be a vote of no confidence.
No confidence, yeah. And Bibi, at the end of his farewell speech, said in English, it was like Arnold Schwarzenegger, "I'll be back."
Yeah. I mean, it just might be. Which, by the way, speaking about the Ra'am party and Abbas, who heads the Ra'am party, that's part of the ruling coalition now. You know, again, the Hadids just can't help themselves. I think it was Bella Hadid who has 43 million followers, who took to Twitter to attack him, like, "How dare you? You know, you're a traitor in essence to the Palestinian people. You know, with joining a government, an apartheid government, and all this stuff." I'm like, just the irony in that statement, that the leader of the Islamicist party, Ra'am, is a member of the ruling coalition of Israel, and she's accusing him of joining an apartheid government. I'm just like,
Yeah, how can you be part of the government and be an apartheid government? It flies in the face of logic. It just flies in the face of logic. Speaking of flying in the face of logic, I don't know if it's flying in the face, but you know, the ceasefire is very tenuous as this week all of a sudden gas balloons were launched into Israel from the West Bank. And
I think these are serious serious fires into communities, burning down, you know, multiple communities, homes, farmland, et cetera, like very serious, especially as you're getting to the dry summer. Their wet season's the winter, the dry season's their summer. But you got to, these incendiary balloons, they started using back in 2014. We got really aggressive with them in 2018. And they were, and for a while, I mean, it was like a daily thing. I mean, and thousands of acres, wildlife preserves, farmland, homes were burned and destroyed. These are really sort of like, it's like terror. So look, we all know the ceasefire is tenuous with Gaza, with Hamas.
But we ought to say that Israel then retaliated.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, you don't poke the bear. Really? So they launched these and expected Israel to do nothing. And then Israel launched attacks against Hamas.
Right. I think they're trying to say, no, like, we had a ceasefire. You're not doing this again. Because they literally, in the midst of ceasefires, this is how Hamas would normally work. They would randomly launch rockets every once in a while into Ashdod or into Sderot or Ashkelon. And they would do these terror balloons, in essence, that would just incendiary fires, or very serious arson fires. And, you know, the world sort of looked the other way, and Israel was dealing with this on pretty much weekly, if not daily basis sometimes. So I think, you know, saying, no, we're not going to put up with this time.
Well, rightfully so. And what I don't understand is the Israeli and Jew haters then lash out at Israel for dare retaliating after they've been attacked. I don't understand how blind people can be. If you attack someone and then you say, "Well, you're the aggressor because you retaliated after we attacked you." No, come on.
This is why they're winning the social media war, because first of all, there's way more voices that they could tweet. Jews are like less than a half a percent of the world population, and less than 2% of the U.S. population, right? So you know, almost half of the Jews in the world live in this country, the other half in Israel, and a few others scattered around. But you know, they're winning the social media wars, and out there are spreading these lies. And then Israel, this is what millions and millions of people only see on social media, and so they always assume Israel's the aggressor, just like, you know, Stanford University, they're Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, pretty much not wanting to do anything with anti-Semitism and sort of labeling Jews as these sort of white supremacists, like in that you have to have your whiteness accountability, that you are a privileged white identity, and that we are not going to talk about your Jewish ancestral identity.
Anti-Semitism. And two researchers at Stanford spoke out.
Yeah.
Researchers, obviously, but said this must stop. This must end.
Exactly. So they were, you know, and this Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, I think their primary complaint, and the Brandeis Center, you know, argued that, you know, so much of these DEI programs, in essence, promote anti-Semitic tropes concerning Jewish power, conspiracy, and control, and excludes Jews from talking about their history of anti-Semitism, about their history of bigotry and racism. I mean, and of course, here we are in the middle of a parabolic rise of anti-Semitism in the world, and Jew hatred, and Jews are, you know, this is part of that whole, you know, and as I call it, it's just part of the whole big scheme, the whole grand lie. Like Jews are white power. They're you know, colonizers. They're this, and thinking you take away the fact that Jews are actually indigenous people to the Middle East, specifically to Israel. The majority of Jews, in particular over in Israel, are not white. That we are Mizrahi. We're Sephardic. We're Arab Jews. It's like they take that away from the dialogue. Like, they don't want people to know who you are. They take away from the dialogue the fact that for the last 2,000 plus years, Jews have been attacked because they've been considered not white, but in contaminants and contaminators of whatever the white race is at issue. I mean, it's sort of trying to shift this dialogue, rewrite history, and it's very, very dangerous. Very dangerous. And if people don't know better, they, you know, in the name of wokeness and wanting to do the right thing, people will just go along with the storyline. But yeah. this is serious. This is very dangerous.
I think, quite frankly, that both Israel and the American Jewish community needs to mount an effort, a public relations effort. And I don't think we do that well sometimes, quite frankly, that we're on the defense and having to fend off anti-Semitism. But I think we need to go on the offense, quite frankly, with social media and with a public relations campaign to set the record straight. And I think we fall short on that. But I think that there might be a resurgence of an offensive effort, because with the recent hostilities in the Middle East, 3/4 of American Jews now say they are concerned about anti-Semitism in this country.
Not just concerned, but they're afraid. They're afraid for their physical safety and well-being. You know, ADL polled over 77% of Jews have more fear now than they did just a few months ago. I mean, this is really frightening when you think about those levels. This increased threat of violence and harassment of Jews around the world, and in particular in this country. You know, and Jews are feeling increasingly isolated.
You talked about it with the rally in support of Israel a couple of weeks ago. Talk a little bit for those who missed it. I thought it's really significant.
It is. I mean, you know, here we are doing a peace rally, and it was, you know, it was a community event, and you had members of the Jewish community, members of the Christian community, others were invited. And there we are, you know, sort of on stage blessing, you know, the Palestinian people with peace and praying that, you know, Hashem, the God of Shalom, blesses them with peace. And, you know, the protesters show up and, you know, they're, you know, with their little loudspeakers and posters, you know, I will use this term lightly, pro-Palestinian protesters, because I personally don't think they were there to express their love and concern for the Palestinian people. That's not what they say. That's not their speech. It's not their rhetoric. They were there calling Israel, you know, saying, accusing Israel of genocide, accusing Jews of, you know, calling them baby murderers, baby killers, and you know, shouting all kinds of expletives at children and elderly, literally trolling and following elderly to their cars, you know, screaming at them that Hitler was right, Hitler's come, a new Hitler's going to rise up and come back for you, you know, new Hitler's going to kill you. This is, you know, these threats of what was even happening here in downtown Tampa a few weeks ago, but this is what's happening all around the country. So, you know, it's very real, you know, and this is where, you know, there was a report done on anti-Semitism being mainstreamed, and it was focusing specifically in Western Europe, but where like the far left in particular, and it noted that in the far left political parties, like the progressive left, that there is this, their speech and their rhetoric is so anti-Israel and is it is laden with Jew hatred, and it's frightening. And they noticed that the mirroring, and we've talked about this for a while, how that Jew hatred, how their words, you know, pretty much are no different than what we hear from the far right. It's like, do you guys realize that you sound the same?
That's right. I mean, it is ironic. It is ironic. The hate from the far right, the far left, it does mirror each other. And well, listen, it's not just in Western Europe. It's not just the United States. It's in Florida. WPTV, yeah. It's a TV station on the east coast of Florida, did a really jarring piece about anti-Semitism, and that it's centered more in South Florida than here, although we've certainly experienced it here as the Florida Holocaust Museum a couple of weeks ago was desecrated. But it's happening. And those that say that there doesn't have to be a voice to speak out against anti-Semitism are ignorant, foolish, and are just discriminatory toward the Jewish people, even if they don't realize that they are being discriminatory. But let's listen to this piece, and it may shake you up. It did me. Here's the piece from WPTV.
Harassment, vandalism, assaults, and even Zoom meetings and services being disrupted by graphic and racist messages. Anti-Semitism has been on the rise in America, and the Sunshine State is seeing a surge in incidents. Tonight, WPTV News Channel 5's Ryan Hughes zeroes in on South Florida and the rising costs of security.
From Boca Raton to Tequesta, Palm Beach County is home to the most Jewish Americans in South Florida, and the population is increasing rapidly.
We're seeing a strong Jewish community growing in Boynton, Palm Beach Gardens, Jupiter.
But according to the Anti-Defamation League, Florida is now also home to the fourth most anti-Semitic incidents in the United States.
We went out to investigate, and it wasn't just one, but it was many and multiple.
Earlier this year, Rabbi Andrew Rosenkranz says swastikas were found drawn on windows of this vacant restaurant in Wellington around the corner from his synagogue, Temple Beth Torah.
When you see a symbol like that, and you're a member of a community that it's directed towards, you know that there are people out there who hate you.
The ADL just released its audit of anti-Semitic incidents, which says Florida saw a 40% increase in 2020 compared to 2019. And the ADL's heat map shows most of the incidents happening in South Florida.
But in the last 3 years, we have seen the highest numbers of anti-Semitic incidents targeting the Jewish community since we started recording the audit in 1979.
Yael Hirschfield is the interim regional director of the ADL's Florida office. She says the lockdown at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic did not prevent the hate, and those who peddle it started infiltrating new spaces.
So for example, Shabbat services at synagogues that were being held over Zoom, and we learned this new term now, Zoom bombing, were being infiltrated by haters.
A new Pew Research Center report released this month not only shows a rise in anti-Semitism, it also says more than half of Jewish Americans feel less safe than 5 years ago.
And now Jewish institutions and synagogues are making upgrades and spending a significant amount of money on security.
Over the past 2 years, we have brought in about $700,000 in federal funding to go to about a dozen or so different Jewish institutions to support things like panic buttons, cameras on the outside.
The Jewish Federation of Palm Beach County tells WPTV 5 years ago, security spending was minimal. But now it's working with the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, and local law enforcement to ensure everyone's safety while also investing in education to combat anti-Semitism.
Over $600,000 is being spent on an annual basis to help support the community advocacy and educational needs in our community.
And at Temple Beth Torah,
this is our memorial wall.
Rabbi Rosenkranz says hate is a learned trait. He teaches love and tolerance, and although it's a strain on the budget, he says he cannot afford not to also focus on security.
We now have the ritual of a bar mitzvah, we have the ritual of a wedding ceremony, the Jewish ritual of a funeral, now we have the ritual of security.
By the way, Rabbi Andrew Rosenkrantz, who was in that speech, grew up in Tampa. His mom is a good friend, Judy Rosenkrantz, a lot of you know, who's very active in the Jewish community. He used to, I think, head up the ADL down in South Florida, and I've talked to him several times. Great guy. But there's that Tampa connection with it. But it is pervasive. It really is pervasive. We cannot turn a blind eye to the anti-Semitism that's going on.
Right. I mean, look, you know, this is sort of, again, I mean, in the midst of, which, by the way, I mean, you and I are very strong supporters of the Black community and of diversity and equality. And, you know, we've shown that in our programming. And I think that's, you know, a lot of our program we're very proud of in that regard. But but you see where, again, we've talked about this, you know, particularly with California schools, but now we're seeing it. The next example is in Virginia, where I don't understand what the schools are thinking. Like, do they just think they're being progressive? Do they think this is being, you know, they're demonstrating their wokeness to diversity? I don't know. But this is a high school in, Falls Church, Virginia, Fairfax County. So they have their keynote speaker for the high school graduation. Her name, Abrar Omesh. She had been known as a, you know, look, she's an organizer. This woman was invited to come speak to the students. And it was interesting. This is the same woman who just, you know, a week or so before had tweeted out, you know, "Hurts my heart to celebrate while Israel kills Palestinians and desecrates the Holy Land right now. Apartheid and colonialization were wrong yesterday and will be today, here and there." So this is a woman who clearly has Jew hatred, who, again, is just sort of demonizing Israel, is sort of spreading these lies out there. And then she's in essence going there and telling the students to cause good trouble. Well, what does that mean? You know, I don't mind that phrase and how it had been used historically. You know, there's a time, for instance, in the civil rights movement. But this is what she's saying. I mean, what are you talking about? Cause good trouble, be on the right side of history. I mean, you're spreading lies about colonialization, apartheidism. You know about Israel killing Palestinians and desecrating the Holy Land. This is a woman who's being asked to give this keynote speech to these high school graduates. And of course, the student president, the class president, you know, did the Pledge of Allegiance, and he said, "One nation under Allah."
As I say, yeah, "One nation under Allah" is what they said. I don't know. I just don't know.
It's so disturbing, though. But this is like, who invited her? And did anybody do a background check or fact check and say, is this really someone who we want to be an example for our students when we look at her tweets? I mean, is this really a part of that? The message we want to share on diversity, equality, inclusion. I mean, I'm sure if there's a Jewish student there, they probably felt very isolated, very targeted, and I would have been terrified.
Absolutely.
If I was a Jewish student in that audience.
Absolutely.
I mean, this was really concerning, but it seems to be, you know, a growing norm in this country, and people are just remaining silent about it. I know. It makes me very sad.
Listen, we got to take a break. We will be back on a terrific interview about Sephardic Jews, and it's fascinating. I find it fascinating, and I hope you will as well. This is The Third Opinion.
More Third Opinion is coming right up. Got a comment on one of our podcasts? Want to make a suggestion for a future podcast? Then head to thirdopinionpodcast.com. That's our website. If you've missed some podcasts, you can check out our archives there too. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to The Third Opinion. Two Jews, three opinions. I am Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And this is a interview coming up that is near and dear to your heart. Loreen.
It is, you know. Well, you know, I much awaited because I think we had mentioned that we were going to be playing this interview a couple weeks ago, but then we had Israel was under attack, and we felt it was really important that we focus our attention on that for a few weeks. But this is Serena Rofe. She heads up the Sephardic Genealogy Division of the organization Jewish Gen. It's Jewish G-E-N. One word, which is an organization that really focuses on the genealogy of Sephardic Mizrahi Jews. These are the Jews of Northern Africa, the Middle East, the Mediterranean. She herself is a Syrian Jew. And it's a two-part interview, so we'll play part one today, and we'll get to part two. And then, of course, we're going to be following up with another expert. His name is Adam Brown, who literally is the foremost expert in the world on Sephardic genealogy. But it's very, you know, near and dear to us.
It is.
So,
and
Serena.
Serena tells us, first of all, a little bit about her history. Here's Serena Rafe.
Yes.
So I grew up in Brooklyn Syrian Jewish community. Both my parents were Syrian Jews. Their parents, so my parents were first generation, I'm second generation. Their parents, my grandparents, came to America in the early part of the 20th century. They both married here. Both sets of grandparents married here in America. And I was raised in that community early in my life. We were in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, which was where the community resided for about 40 years after leaving the Lower East Side. And then they moved to the Ocean Parkway area of Brooklyn, starting in the late 40s, but by, I would say, the late 60s, pretty much everyone had left Bensonhurst, and my family as well. And so I was raised with a set of values that and traditions based on the Syrian Jewish community. So, for example, our community was, we started out as peddlers right off of the ship on Ellis Island. They started off as peddlers. They moved to peddling carts and eventually into retail. And as the years went on, they moved from retail to wholesale so that they wouldn't have to work on the Sabbath. So the community is very tradition-minded. We are very respectful of our rabbis. Most of our community, well, I should say that my family comes from Aleppo, but a good part of the community also comes from Damascus. And you have to understand that in Aleppo and Damascus, in the old country, these communities really didn't know each other, because 150 miles 100 years ago was a really long distance. These people didn't have cars, so, you know, they were riding on donkeys and things like that. So they first really came together in America, and they came together for certain societies, like the burial society, but they were really separate in many ways. They didn't intermarry for several decades, just between Damascus Jews and Aleppo Jews, which was really interesting to me. And then
I'm guessing, you know, that your family, when they came to the country, they spoke fluent Arabic. A lot of people don't understand that a lot of the Mizrahi Jews, they're Arabic Jews. They spoke fluent Arabic. That was their home language.
Correct. My parents' first language was Arabic, because Arabic was the language of the home. Also, as now growing up, my parents spoke Arabic to each other when they didn't want us to understand, but they spoke English to us. They learned, my parents all learned Arabic when they went to school, because their parents didn't know English. Their parents only spoke Arabic and acquired some. You know, as I was growing up, my grandparents spoke, you know, I would guess, I don't want to call it foreigner English, but they spoke English as their second language, and they would frequently say, why don't you learn Arabic? You know, so it became the kind of the family joke. Out of my 50-something first cousins, I think two of them can speak fluent Arabic.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it really depends family to family. I know I have friends who similarly came from, whether it was Syria or Iraq or different Mizrahi communities, and they actually do, and that was their first language, they're fluent Arabic, even before Hebrew or English. So very, very intriguing. And, you know, I think it's interesting, obviously, you know, we were talking about this before the call, that, you know, even though these are ancient communities, the Syrian community, the Iraqi community, the community in Persia, Iran, Morocco, Tunisia, these are all ancient communities where Jews have lived for 2,000 plus years. But they lived sort of, even though they lived among the people, they also lived in many ways in second-class citizens in the Muslim countries because of a lot of what the Quran says about Jews not being equal. But obviously there were reasons that forced your parents, your grandparents to come to this country. Some of them were the pogroms that were happening. But in your family instance, what was the driving factor that sort of caused them, forced them to leave Syria to come to America?
So there are three reasons why people left. The impetus was that in we lived in, first of all, you have to understand that in the entire Ottoman Empire and in all Muslim countries, Jews had a status called dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. Basically, it means it's a protected, you're protected community because you believe in one God, Jews and Christians. And because of that, we were allowed to live as autonomous communities. So that meant that we had to keep our own records. Jews, the communities themselves had to keep their own records. There were no vital records. So you didn't have vital records for birth, for death, for marriage. Those records were kept within the community, okay? And in exchange, the community had to pay what's called a jizha tax. It's a tax on able-bodied men in the community, and that tax had to be collected by the community and handed over to the government, okay? And in exchange, they had military protection. They lived autonomously. Nobody bothered them. And in situations where a Jew and a Muslim would interact, the Muslim would always win out in court because they could never take the word of a Jew over a Muslim. That was Islamic law. So understanding that, in 1907, the Ottoman Empire fell. And the Young Turks took over, and they ended dhimmi status. And what that meant was that suddenly teenage boys were being conscripted into the army, the Turkish army. My own grandfather was taken off the streets of Aleppo and sent to the army, and he was supposed to serve 25 years. He luckily escaped.
Wow.
And he came back. He was able to escape, and he was able to come to America in 1920. And I heard this story from many, many, many people that I've interviewed over time. That so what happened was, as boys were disappearing, families started just sending their sons to America because they didn't want them to serve in the army. And those families, eventually those men would go to the Lower East Side, and little by little they would bring their families. The second impetus had to do with economics. Economics during the early part of the 20th century, the late 19th century, was really, really bad because the Ottoman Empire had gone bankrupt and the Suez Canal opened in 1869. And when the Suez Canal opened, it ended the caravan trade, which went from, you know, west to east and east to west. And Aleppo and Damascus were along that caravan route. So suddenly now they had no way to sell their wares. And that was the second impetus. And then the third impetus, which was that in 1901, Theodor Herzl had claimed at the World Jewish Congress that there should be a state of Israel, that we should establish, you know, Zionism started, people were, you know, even though in Arab countries they weren't Zionists because they thought they were living happily, just the idea that that there might be a Jewish state in the middle of the Middle East was problematic, and Jews started to get persecuted. So those were kind of the three factors. And the third factor really played out more after World War II when Israel was created. But early 20th century, when my grandparents came, the bigger issues were economic and conscription.
Right, because I know, you know, obviously the Iraqi Jews suffered the pogroms, so the Moroccan, Libyan, the Egyptians, the Tunisians, you know, being forced out. Some of it was pre-World War II, some of it was after World War II, all in the beginning of the century. So it's interesting, the Syrian story, with the Syrian Jews being there, you know, that rich culture and history there. I mean, for people who don't know the map, Syria is just geographically, it's the northern, the northwest, sorry, the northeast border of Israel.
Right. But, well, you also have to understand that in Syria, there was a deep belief that God protected them from any issues because they had a document under the synagogue in the cave called the Keter, the crown, the crown. It's called the Aleppo Codex. It's known as the Aleppo Codex. Uh-huh. The Aleppo Codex sat under the synagogue in the cave for hundreds of years, about 800 years. It was in Egypt before that, where Maimonides consulted it when he was writing his Code of Jewish Law. And it's the earliest known document, manuscript of the Bible. It's not a codex is in the form of a book. It's not a scroll. And it was written, Maimonides used it for the Mishnah Torah to write it.
Wow.
It's a very special document. It's written in three columns, and it's vocalized according to the Tiberian system where vowels are placed beneath the letters. It's not the Babylonian system, and it represents the cancellation of the Bible, and it's considered the book, and the authority on the cancellation of the Torah.
That's amazing. Where is that? Where is it today? Was it destroyed? Is it still there?
No, it was transported. It was during the pogroms in Damascus. It was smuggled into Turkey, and it's now in Israel, in the same building as the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, okay. All right. So in the Israel Museum, in that building, by the way, that building, for those who've not visited, the Israel Museum, where they have the Bible building, where they have the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I just spent countless hours there just to be able to read that in the translations, and just such a fascinating, amazing place. Well, that's such an incredible story, Serena. Thank you for educating us. I have never heard of that, which I'm actually quite surprised by that. So
there was actually an edict that it was never supposed to leave Aleppo. And in 1957, Israel's chief rabbi canceled the edict, and he said, you have to get it out of the country. And then it was moved out in 1957.
Well, thank God, because if it wasn't, I mean, with all the destruction in Syria in these last decade, I mean, it probably wouldn't have survived.
Monty Friedman wrote a wonderful book about it, because there are some missing pages. But it was given to the Ben Zvi Institute.
Amazing. All right. Well, let's switch gears a little bit, because I do want to talk about your work that you do with Jewish Gen. I mean, I know recently, because Jewish Gen has been, especially the last 6 months, they've been focusing on a lot of, they do YouTube talks, and they talk a lot about the Sephardic dispersion, Sephardic genealogy, adding a lot of history, because a lot of people really don't understand, number one, the Inquisition. Two, they don't understand that Sephrod, which is ancient Spain, was really the heart and soul of the Jewish world outside of Israel. It was the heart and soul of the Jewish world in the diaspora. And how the Inquisition for almost 400 plus years touched, you know, a good part of the entire world. And Jews were running and hiding everywhere. So you did a recent talk on the Jewish Gen YouTube website. Called Post 1492, Sephardic Dispersion and a Guide to Sephardic Genealogy. So let me ask you this. I mean, and by the way, for those of you who are interested, fascinating. I watched it. I could watch it another five times. There are so many little facts and pieces. I learned stuff about my own family that I was like, oh yeah, the naming issue. I'm like, wow, I never even knew that was a Sephardic thing. And then you learn things from listening to you. And so. Explain to the community that's listening sort of what sort of spurred this on, like what's the interest and why you're doing what you're doing at Jewish Gen.
So Sephardic genealogy is very unique and very different because you have to understand a lot of little factors that go into genealogy to understand. First of all, Ashkenazi Jews didn't have surnames until the 19th century, whereas Sephardic Jews who were living in Spain would have had surnames way back to the 12th century.
Wow.
That in alone is like a huge difference in helping you follow your family and helping you follow your family tree. So to understand a little bit about the history, you have to understand that that as Christian Spain was being taken over, as Christians began to take over more and more Spain from the Muslims, which had control of the region for many, many years, that there started to be more of an anti-Semitic feel based on the canons of the church. And because they were fanatic Christians, and they really wanted everyone to be Catholic. And so in 1391, there were huge pogroms, what we would call pogroms, murders, rape, tortures, book burning, all over Spain, and many forced conversions at that time. And in the 100-year period between 1391 and 1492, when the Jews were expelled, you had an understanding, and that's like basically 3 to 4 generations. And what started to happen was you realized that if one person converted, maybe the brother didn't convert, or the sister didn't convert, or the children didn't convert. So what happened was that Jews who had converted were still in their same social circle. They didn't change their house. They were in the same house. And while they might be going to synagogue one day and church the next day, because after their conversion, their social structure remained the same. Because are you not going to go to your brother's kid's bar mitzvah, your nephew's bar mitzvah, just because now you're Catholic? No. So what happened was that there started to be laws that said, now you can't interact. And then there were laws that said, they called them limpia de sangre laws. And that was that there was a difference between the rights of a new Christian versus the rights of someone born Christian.
And, of course, we will have part two next week on the Third Opinion podcast, which you can get anywhere on iTunes, on Spotify, wherever you get your favorite podcast, and I hope you will join us.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say it's iPodcast, Spotify, Google Play.
Yeah,
and it's the Third Opinion podcast.
Right. That's right. So we'll look forward to that because I thought she was just fascinating, especially when her family was giving her a rough time. Why don't you speak Arabic?
Right. Well, you know, you have to remember, I mean, so many Jews, their first language was Arabic. And even today, I mean, many Jews still speak fluent Arabic in Israel and even in this country, those that came from Syria, different places. So, but what's really fascinating about what she's doing, because there's so much interest in the Sephardic world about their roots and return to these different countries or where they came from. And Sephardic Jews, which is very distinct from Ashkenazi Jews, Sephardic Jews, you could follow their names and there's different DNA evidence. So I think Adam Brown, another expert we'll be talking to, has been able to tie.
I'm an Ashkenazi Jew. My family all came from Eastern Europe. So there's a lot of us as well. Hey, listen, I've got to say something about the Hillsborough Republican Party. I have some friends who are Jewish who are staunch Republicans. And they are very upset with the Hillsborough Republican Party, which has invited Marjorie Taylor Greene as their keynote speaker for the Lincoln dinner that they have every year. That's a big fundraiser for them. Marjorie Taylor Greene is the one that said Jewish lasers started the fires in California. She equated wearing masks with wearing Jewish stars. This week she visited the Holocaust Museum and went, oh, I never realized the Holocaust was so bad. I don't believe it. She is a QAnon supporter, and she is going to be the main speaker at the Hillsborough Republican Party Lincoln Day dinner. Yeah. And I have talked to some Jewish friends who, as I say, are staunch Republicans, but just can't understand what the party was thinking. I mean, she has said so many anti-Semitic things, and now they're bringing her in. I don't know what they were thinking.
Well, I will tell you, I'm first of all, the comment about the Holocaust, unfortunately, is probably true. I mean, you and I have talked about this, how little most Americans actually know about the Holocaust, which in and of itself is just dumbfounding. And another reason why, when you accuse Israel of engaging in genocide, it's so offensive to the Jewish people. But I will give her credit because she did apologize, which, you know, some of these other haters have not apologized. And so I had to give her credit for at least apologizing for her.
To me, it's too little too late. But we're going to have to wait until the Third Opinion podcast, because you know what that music means? We are out of time. This is the Third Opinion. Two Jews, three opinions. I am Mike Thiessen.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our podcast for this week. Remember to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.